Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, two quick reminders. If you haven't yet, please check out Welcome to the Crusades at welcometothecrusades.com. We're going to be releasing a bonus episode, and if you want some good, fun Crusades content that's a little bit escapist, but also provides insight into the world we live in today, check that out. That's, again, welcometothecrusades.com. And
we're at least one bonus episode, maybe more than one, who knows?
Maybe more. Oh my God, Derek.
I don't want to limit people to one bonus episode. I mean, you gotta buy it, but you know, you could be getting 20, 30, who knows?
Oh my God. These are not contractual promises. Everyone listening, be like the micro machine guy. In addition to that, we are so close to getting 1,000 reviews on Apple. So if you haven't yet, please pause this wonderful episode, take a moment, and review us on Apple Podcasts. Then I will stop asking everyone once we hit 1,000. We really appreciate that, and it's something you could do, especially if for whatever reason you can't afford to subscribe to the podcast right now. We get that, but you can help us out by reviewing us at Apple Podcasts. So really, it takes a couple minutes and really does a lot for us. So if you haven't yet, please do that. All right, Derek, let's jump right in 2 feet forward, and let's get into the news. Probably the first thing we should talk about is that we are on the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the first atomic bomb in world history on Hiroshima. The bomb dropped on Nagasaki 3 days later, August 6th and August 9th, I believe. So, Derek, do you have any thoughts about that in a moment when bombing is still going on, obviously, all around the world by the United States? I have some thoughts, but I'll let you go first.
My thoughts are mostly that we seem to be losing, and maybe this is because the memory's fading and there aren't that many survivors left to tell their stories, although they've been doing so for years now. But we seem to be losing the taboo on nuclear weapons. It started out with people talking about, so-called low-yield nuclear weapons. I mean, it's just absurd conversations about whether it's possible to win a nuclear exchange by, you know, using a weapon that's not quite powerful enough to trigger a full-on war, but could, it started with this kind of chatter among the sociopaths who talk about this kind of stuff in the military establishment or the think tank establishment. But now we're at the point where, you know, India and Pakistan are staring each other down. We're involved in a shooting war a couple of months ago. You've got Russian leaders, Putin every once in a while, Vladimir Putin every once in a while, but certainly Dmitry Medvedev more recently, just kind of openly musing about World War III between Russia and the U.S. Donald Trump's moving nuclear submarines around. We can talk about this in a bit here, but it just feels like we're slipping into a dangerous place with just the way that people talk about these weapons, as though their use is conceivable in a combat situation. So that's the thing. I think is most pressing on this, nice round number anniversary when it's time to take stock of where we've come. I think we're moving into some dangerous territory.
Maybe I'll get a little historical and just talk about the perversities that were attendant with the weapon when it was first used. One of the things that I think is ironic and something that I learned, and I don't think that most people know, is, Derek, did you know that the bomb was actually perceived as a precision weapon? So going into World War II, basically, if you think about the military, the reason that there are separate services is that they have independent strategic missions. The Army controls the ground, the Navy controls the sea, and the Air Force controls the air. But actually, initially, the air weapon was conceived as adjacent to the land weapon, the Army, that planes were basically designed to help militaries invade and help people win wars. So over the course of the 1920s and 1930s, army air officers, because of course the Air Force was part of the army until the late 1940s, were trying to develop an independent strategic mission. And they, to do that, they had to argue that the Air Force in and of itself could win a war. And what they claimed from Billy Mitchell, famous Billy Mitchell on Downward, was that the air weapon was a precision weapon, that you would be able to fly over your enemy's army, fly over your enemy's navy, and you could very precisely bomb things like transportation networks or electrical communication systems or factories, and you would be able to end wars cheaply and humanely. And in arguing that, then the Air Force would actually be given an independent strategic mission and a reason to be separate from the army and become its own independent military service. And this was the idea that the U.S. Army Air Forces took into World War II, this notion of precision bombing. But as anyone who studied World War II knows, and if you've seen those pictures, it turns out that that doesn't actually end wars. One, it's actually quite difficult to be a precision bomber, to precisely bomb something, particularly given the technological limitations at the time. Radar was developed during World War II, but it wasn't there at the beginning. So if you see the bombings of Europe with the 8th Air Force, or if you see, you know, Curtis LeMay over in Japan, Curtis LeMay was also in Europe, but also over in Japan, the firebombing of Tokyo, this was a problem, because if the Air Force is just going to level something, that's not really the precision upon which the argument for independent service partially rested. The idea was that the air weapon was actually quote-unquote progressive. They used the language of the time. It was the weapon of the future. It wasn't the brutalities of the past. And something that I always found interesting about the atomic bomb after it was dropped is that there is a message from, I believe it was Lars Norstad, who was a high-ranking Air Force officer right after the bomb was dropped, that essentially said that it's the most precise weapon on Earth. One bomb, one city. And so I just think that it's crazy. And he literally says, like, people are going to say this amazing. Is... People are going to say this is not a precise weapon, but oh my God, look how quickly we ended the war with two bombs, you know? And so I just think that's important, because I think it's indicative of how these American fantasies about how wars could be fought cleanly, which have taken a hit in recent years in particular, but I think it's always bubbling under in American discourse and the American imagination, like, very quickly is able to bleed over into justification for things that are just horrific crimes against humanity, whether you want to think about that in the legal sense that emerges from the Nuremberg trials, or just, you know, killing a lot of people with one bomb is terrible. And so I just think that's always so very interesting about the atomic bomb, that very quickly that was reimagined in this sort of American imagination, to reuse the term imagined, as a precision weapon, when I would say it's very much a blunt force instrument. So, yeah,
we can talk ourselves into anything, I guess.
It's impressive. All right. So on those reflections, why don't we move into current news? And why don't we start with Israel-Palestine? And Derek, tell us about Benjamin Netanyahu talking about quote unquote full occupation in Gaza.
Yeah, multiple outlets, Israeli media outlets, reported this on Monday that Netanyahu had taken the decision to order a complete military occupation of Gaza. You may ask, is that not what they're doing already? And apparently it is not. No, I mean, it really isn't. What they've been doing is occupying corridors within the territory. So you've heard about these corridors, you know, bisecting it north and south, or the corridor around Rafah. And they've been occupying the area around major population centers, Gaza City in particular, but sort of establishing a perimeter around the entire territory. They have not moved in and attempted to occupy, which comes with, you know, administration and all manner of other obligations. They've not really attempted to do that so far. But Netanyahu is under some pressure. Ceasefire talks have, of course, collapsed. We talked about this last week. The U.S. has shifted its focus from a piecemeal ceasefire deal in stages to what they've called an all-or-nothing deal. But there's been no engagement with Hamas. There's been no resumption of talks in Qatar. So effectively, that process is stalled out. But there is mounting pressure within Israel on Netanyahu to look like, at least look like he's doing something new or something different to try to recover the remaining captives who are being held in the territory. This comes after Hamas released a video, I believe over the weekend or perhaps late last week, showing the effect of the starvation campaign, the effect on children and Palestinians, but also included images of one of the Israeli captives who is starving, just like everybody else in Gaza is starving. But that sent, you know, Netanyahu into a tailspin. He started demanding that the Red Cross and humanitarian organizations that he's done nothing but, you know, sort of complain about this entire time, started demanding that they, you know, go in and take care of these hostages or captives, rather. It was clear in the days after the release of this video that he felt like he was under political pressure to do something, or at least appear to be doing something. And so the decision, I guess, is that he wants to militarily occupy the territory, even though militarily occupying the territory is going to come with a lot more intensive ground activity. Presumably, you know, it leaves the IDF vulnerable to Hamas and other militants in the territory. Will increase their exposure to potential attacks. It will also increase the risk to the captives because the Israeli military will have to go in and fight, presumably, in places where these captives are being held that it has avoided, in its approach to this situation so far. There's been pushback to this from inside the Israeli security establishment in one form from kind of retired senior IDF officers and other security officials who sent a letter to Donald Trump over the weekend, more or less asking him to take the wheel away from Netanyahu and resolve the situation, end the what they call the war in Gaza. That's, you know, the first sign, I think, of discontent or disenchantment within the security establishment at the way Netanyahu has been running things. But also there have been reports, and they can't say this publicly because of the chain of command, but there have been reports that senior IDF officers are not happy about this proposal either. Eyal Zamir, the commander of the IDF, whom Netanyahu appointed to that post earlier this year, basically with the understanding that Zamir would do whatever he ordered him to do without question, reportedly pushed back against this plan in a meeting with Netanyahu and other senior kind of cabinet officials on Tuesday. He presented them with alternatives to expand the IDF's ground presence in Gaza without fully occupying, you know, Gaza City, Khan Yunis, all these urban, or what's left of these urban areas. So clearly, if even Zamir, who was seen as this loyal kind of foot soldier who would do what Netanyahu told him, is pushing back, it seems pretty clear that the Israeli military does not want to do this. Nevertheless, there's supposed to be a meeting of the Israeli security cabinet today.
Nevertheless, they persisted.
There's supposed to be a meeting of the security cabinet today, at which time they will probably vote to go ahead with what Netanyahu wants to do. There have been meetings all along, and every time there's a meeting of the security cabinet or the full cabinet, there's speculation that this is going to be it. They're going to, you know, take a vote internally on whether to do this, whether to proceed. They haven't done that yet. There's been no final decision taken, but I think probably it's coming in the next, you know, day or so.
All right, Derek, let's talk about the United States expanding the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Alongside then the Israeli, full Israeli takeover of Gaza, Donald Trump is going to take over the humanitarian relief operation. That's got to be a reassuring thought to anybody who's starving in Gaza, that Donald Trump is going to be on the job. But this was the outcome of Steve Witkoff. We'll talk a little bit more about him later, but Steve Witkoff, of course, visited Israel and Gaza last week. He visited over the weekend the territory, basically a very curated, staged entry into the territory, where I think he observed operations at a Gaza, so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation distribution site, and then that was pretty much it. And naturally, then the result of this is the U.S. is going to take over, quote unquote, managing the humanitarian operation in Gaza by basically expanding the GHF operation. Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, was on, I believe, Fox News on Wednesday and said that the plan is to scale the number of GHF distribution sites up from its current number of 4 to 16, and that they would expand the hours that these centers are open to, Huckabee said, as much as 24 hours a day. People would still be required to go to these distribution sites where they can be corralled, cordoned, and as we've seen, gunned down en masse by Israeli soldiers and or mercenaries. But there would be more of them, so that at least might address some, I guess, concerns about people having to travel long distances, let's say from the northern part of Gaza all the way to the south where the distribution sites currently are set up. I think there's one in central Gaza, but the rest are in the south. So there may be a bit more geographic dispersion, which would be marginally improved, but you would still be putting these people in very serious danger based on what we've seen, the way that this kind of farcical humanitarian operation has run so far. You'd still be putting people at high risk of being killed or, you know, trampled or, you know, in any number of physical threats that come with these sites. But that seems to be the plan. So, you know, along with the military occupation, we're going to see more of the GHF, I guess, at a time when the international NGO community, aid organizations are, you know, calling for the GHF to be shut down completely. We're going to instead get more of it.
Let's stay in the region and let's talk about the Lebanese government attempting to disarm Hezbollah.
This is potentially not great. I mean, at the strong urging of the Trump administration, of course, and the Israeli government, which doesn't do it so much urging as it's just continued to violate repeatedly the November ceasefire with Hezbollah by bombing southern Lebanon at will and maintaining a troop presence in parts of southern Lebanon, continuing to conduct ground raids. Nevertheless, between that and the pressure that they're getting from the U.S. Government, the Lebanese cabinet voted on Tuesday internally with ministers that are aligned or friendly with Hezbollah walking out, apparently, of the chamber, or walking out before the vote, voted to order the Lebanese army. This is according to Prime Minister Nawaf Salam. Order the Lebanese army to devise what he called an implementation plan to restrict weapons to official state security forces by the end of the year. That doesn't mean they're going to try to implement the implementation plan. You know, they may just devise the plan and let it sit there for a while rather than move forward with it. But the aim is at this point to disarm Hezbollah. The Hezbollah being the main, you know, kind of target for this this move to monopolize violence in the state. The question of whether the Lebanese government is prepared to disarm Hezbollah or try to disarm Hezbollah by force remains an open one. They certainly haven't ruled it out. But to be completely frank, the Lebanese army does not have the capability, most likely, even in Hezbollah's current relatively weakened condition after, you know, the pounding that it took from the Israelis last year. There is a lot of question about whether the Israeli or the Lebanese army, rather, could by force take weapons away from this group without sparking a civil war. So that's the sort of the stakes here. Hezbollah issued a statement on Wednesday calling the proposal to disarm it a grave sin, and saying that it plans to just continue operating and pretend that this statement doesn't exist and that it was never announced, and presumably that the plan, whatever implementation plan follows, doesn't exist either. Hezbollah officials have suggested, Naim Qassem in particular, the leader now of Hezbollah, has suggested that the group would be open to discussions on some sort of national security strategy that might incorporate Hezbollah alongside the regular Lebanese military, maybe open to discussions about a future where Hezbollah is more of a political party than a militant group or military paramilitary group. But only after the Israeli government stops attacking Lebanon and there's some assurance that it won't do so in the future, which there is none of that. So, you know, at this point, Hezbollah says it, you know, regards any effort to disarm it as, you know, people doing the work of the Israeli military for them. So it's very reluctant to participate in that. And this could get, I mean, as I say, there's a lot of open questions at this point about how this would come about, what the plan would look like, whether there's any willingness to go through with the plan, whether there's willingness to go through with the plan if it means employing military force to do so. So a lot of questions that need to be answered. But if they're answered in the wrong way, you could very easily see this breaking out into an internal conflict within Lebanon.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the United States hosting this Armenian-Azerbaijan peace summit.
There were unconfirmed reports earlier this week, mostly kind of local reporters and bloggers and that type of thing, about a planned summit at the White House that was going to take place on Friday. The White House later, after these reports broke, confirmed to the Washington Post that the summit is going to take place. It's going to involve Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev. Both of them will meet with Donald Trump separately. I believe the plan is they will not meet as a threesome. Aliyev and Pashinyan won't meet separately with each other. They'll meet individually with Trump, but then the whole group, the little triumvirate here, will make some sort of a joint announcement regarding the effectively stalled Armenian-Azerbaijani peace process. If people have been paying attention to this story, they will be aware that the two governments did announce earlier this year, I believe it was in March, that they had reached a vague kind of agreement in principle on a peace deal, but there's been no movement since then on sort of fleshing that out into a real actual agreement that could be implemented. The main sticking point, as it has been for months, is the Azerbaijani demand for the opening of a free transit corridor across southern Armenia that would connect Azerbaijan proper to Nakhchivan, which is an exclave. Belongs to Azerbaijan, but lies to the west of Armenia, Azerbaijan to the east. So they're not connected. The Azerbaijanis want a transit corridor that would link them that cuts through Armenian territory. The Armenians are very uncomfortable with an Azerbaijani-controlled transit corridor bisecting their country, as you might imagine. So the proposal that the Trump administration has been making now for quite some time, and it's been unclear whether it was getting any interest from either of the principal parties here, but the proposal they've been making is that the U.S. would manage this corridor, that basically it would be, you know, built and it would be, I guess, it's even been dubbed the Trump Bridge. So yeah, that's great. That would run across southern Armenia, but would be controlled by the U.S. And the idea being that the U.S. could make sure that the Azerbaijanis don't abuse this corridor to try and grab up any Armenian territory or to cut off the Armenian southern border with Iran, which the Armenian government would be very uncomfortable with. The U.S. probably would not be, would probably be thrilled with that, but you know, that I digress. Anyway, the proposal has been that the U.S. would manage this project and make sure that everybody stays on the up and up. And that seems to be the basis for whatever is going to happen on Friday. This joint announcement could be the announcement of a full-fledged peace deal. If it is, then it would certainly be based around the idea of the U.S. taking the lead on this transit project. But we'll have to wait and see.
Let's talk about Trump punishing India for making oil purchases from Russia.
Trump has been threatening for a week or so now after the collapse of trade talks between his administration and the Indian government, first to impose a 25% base tariff on Indian products, which he'd already done, but then to impose some unspecified penalty on additional penalty on top of that on Indian products because of India's continued purchase of Russian oil despite U.S. sanctions. He went ahead with that on Wednesday, doubling the penalty was a doubling of the base 25% tariff. So the tariff effectively is now 50%. It's going to go into effect in 3 weeks, I guess 3 weeks from Wednesday. So there's still time for the Indian government to maybe negotiate their way out of this, or at least negotiate that number down a bit. But it doesn't sound like they're terribly interested, at least so far. Maybe the announcement of what the penalty is and the realization of these 50% tariffs will shake something loose. But it doesn't sound so far, at least, like the Indian government has been very interested in negotiating on this point. They reject basically the idea of the U.S. Dictating to them whose oil they are and are not allowed to buy. India historically filled its large oil needs from the Middle East, but since Russia is the clientele for the Russian energy sector has shrunk in the wake of the Ukraine invasion in 2022, they've been discounting oil prices and pushing hard to sell more to China and India. The Indians have taken that up. They get a good price. They get strengthen their relationship with Russia, which is a major arms supplier and has historically been had pretty close relations with India. So it works out pretty well for them, and they don't seem willing to sort of knuckle under to Trump's demand here. I think particularly galling to the Indians is that the U.S. and Europe are still buying billions of dollars in Russian energy products every year and are not planning to change that. Europe still buys Russian natural gas. The U.S. buys Russian uranium. I mean, it's all very double standard-ish, I guess, hypocritical of the U.S. to single out India in this way, and probably motivated by Trump, less concerned about these Russian oil purchases and more just kind of irritated at the Indian government for not giving in to other demands, whether that's, that they, make one of these pledges to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the U.S. economy or to buy, some absurd amount of U.S. natural gas and energy products as he's made South Korea and the European Union do in their trade deals, or something else. Who knows? Whatever it seems to be irritating Trump. India's part of BRICS. Maybe that has something to do with it. Something has him kind of exercised about the Indian government right now. So I suspect he's latching on to this complaint about Russian oil purchases as an excuse to do something that he wanted to do anyway. But, I'm just speculating.
I don't know. Trump seems more stable than that. Let's talk about Thailand and Cambodia agreeing to the deployment of ceasefire monitors.
This just broke on Thursday. Military officials, defense officials from Thailand and Cambodia had a meeting in Malaysia on Thursday to kind of advance the ceasefire that has tenuously held along the border since they came to an agreement on it last week. They have agreed now after, initial kind of struggles, accusations of ceasefire violations on both sides. I think we talked about this last week. The Thai military is still holding, I believe at this point, 18 Cambodian soldiers. They returned 2 wounded soldiers, but they're still holding 18 Cambodian soldiers who are they detained under circumstances that are disputed between the two countries. And all of these things kind of adding up to make this ceasefire pretty tense, despite the fact that it's notwithstanding the fact that it's held this long. But this should settle things a bit. They've agreed to allow observers from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to send from those countries to send observers to the region to monitor the ceasefire, which should help calm things down a bit. But, who knows how much. But it is a sign that they're progressing slowly toward, actually standing down in a more stable situation. They still haven't agreed on a kind of final ceasefire. This is just an ad hoc thing put in place to stop the fighting. So they're still theoretically negotiating on that, but this is a step toward that, I think.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's move over to Sudan and let's begin with this new RSF atrocity.
The one of Sudan's many NGOs, this the Emergency Lawyers Activist Group, accused the Rapid Support Forces of killing at least 14 civilians in North Darfur State on Saturday. Now, people are aware the RSF has been besieging the capital of North Darfur State, Al-Fashir, for months now. The RSF's newly stood up government, or, you know, quote unquote government, in the administration that they've established in North Darfur State, the governor of that state appointed by the RSF, sent out an advisory to people in Al-Fashir, civilians in Al-Fashir, a couple of days, like late last week, I think Thursday. Advising people to leave the city and saying that if they left the city and headed to a nearby village called Karni, that they would be safe, they'd be protected by the RSF. There were people there to help them, to get them food and other necessary supplies. They would be taken care of. And so a group of civilians who apparently got that message decided to leave the city and head to Karni, where they were gunned down by RSF fighters. 14 of them, as I said, were killed, at least 14 of them. Many more were wounded or taken into custody by the paramilitary. So just basically sounds like the RSF baited these people into an atrocity. And I, you know, maybe it was an error on the ground. Maybe it was a commander who didn't get the memo and you know, acted on his own volition or something, some kind of snafu, or maybe it was a deliberate you know, act to kill these people or to kill as many people as possible. The RSF, you know, famously does not treat the population of Darfur terribly well. It's been accused of multiple war crimes, massacres of civilian populations in that region. So who knows? But yeah, another one of these kind of taking place speaks to, I think, the continued concern here, and especially with people who are still in Al-Fashir who now have to understand that they would likely be, you know, get the same treatment if they were to leave the city. But there are concerns, increasing concerns about the lack of humanitarian aid getting into the city, about possible starvation. The UN World Food Program has warned of this as the siege goes on and it just becomes impossible to manage.
And what about the military accusing the UAE of hiring mercenaries?
Right. The military or the military government, again, you can put that in quotes, I guess, of Sudan issued a statement on Monday that accused the UAE of hiring mostly Colombian, but also other African, you know, people from other African countries, mercenaries to bolster the RSF's ranks. The Sudanese military has accused the UAE of aiding the RSF on multiple occasions in multiple ways. You know, purchasing weapons for it, shipping them into to Darfur for the RSF to use. There are credible international investigations into this that have supported the military allegations. The UAE continually denies that it's been supporting the RSF, but that's flying in the face of, as I say, a lot of evidence to the contrary. On Wednesday, the Sudanese military said that it had destroyed a UAE aircraft at Niala Airport. Niala is the capital of South Darfur State, and also the ostensible capital of this new government that the RSF has put together. And the Sudanese military said that it bombed a plane there, killing a cargo plane, killing at least 40 people. That plane, they claim, was full of again Colombian mercenaries and military equipment procured by the UAE for the RSF. This is at least the second time, to my knowledge, that the Sudanese military has attacked a UAE cargo plane in Niala, both times insisting that it was, you know, there to ferry in military equipment and or additional personnel for the RSF. There was a similar attack back in May that resulted in days of drone attacks on the city of Port Sudan, which is the de facto military capital in the northeastern part of the country, that probably, well, you know, the obvious explanation was the RSF, which has drone capacity, but doesn't really have anybody positioned close enough to Port Sudan to pull that off, but that, you know, that they had carried out that attack in retaliation for this bombing. There were was also speculation at the time that the UAE itself had carried out those attacks on Port Sudan, and we may see something similar emerge after after this latest strike on the plane in Niala.
Okay, on to Ethiopia. Let's talk about this terrible new report on sexual violence in Tigray.
The report comes from two organizations, Physicians for Human Rights and the Organization for Justice and Accountability in the Horn of Africa. They interviewed, they looked at medical records, they interviewed health workers, community leaders, I believe survivors of rampant sexual violence during the 2020 to 2022 war between the Ethiopian government with the support of the Eritrean military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. What they found was, yeah, just as I say, systematic at a level that suggests potentially genocidal intent. They said it rises to the level of crimes against humanity. They found evidence from survivors of soldiers who were expressing their intention to what they said, exterminate the Tigrayan ethnicity, either by, you know, making it impossible for Tigrayan women to reproduce, or you know, forcing them to bear the children of men of other ethnicities. And this is, you know, on the part of Ethiopian soldiers and Eritrean soldiers. The Eritrean military in particular was accused of you know, kind of major heinous human rights violations during that conflict, but so was the Ethiopian military, and for that matter, the TPLF. But yeah, this latest report is quite disturbing. The Guardian reported on it late last week. So if you know, people want to get a sense for how awful that conflict was, and the situation, you know, it still continues to be awful for these women. You know, the humanitarian situation in Tigray remains terrible. Food, medical care, very little of it is it has been, you know, brought back even to kind of pre-war levels, let alone improved beyond that. So it's a disturbing story. But if people want to get a sense for that conflict and that situation, I think maybe important to read.
Let's move on to Russia. So Steve Witkoff has visited Moscow, and it seems like a Putin-Trump meeting might be forthcoming. So Derek, tell us what happened there.
Right. This is in the backdrop. I mean, we said this earlier, of Donald Trump transferring moving two nuclear submarines into position after he and Dmitry Medvedev got into a spat online, essentially, over, you know, who would come off worse in World War III between the U.S. and Russia. So, yeah, a lot of nerves late last week were up. Trump announced this deployment on Friday. And, you know, it doesn't really mean anything, but it doesn't not mean anything. I mean, you know, you move nuclear submarines around, that's a pretty big deal. So, yeah, a lot of tension about this as recently as kind of Friday and over the weekend. But as you say, Steve Witkoff did go to Russia on Wednesday. The other piece of the backdrop of this is Trump has been threatening for since last week, last Monday, Tuesday, to impose major new economic sanctions or tariffs, you know, penalties of some kind on the Russian economy on Friday, you know, tomorrow, basically, well, today when people listen to this, that he's planning to impose these new penalties because the Russians haven't made any moves toward negotiating peace deal in Ukraine. And so this Witkoff visit was supposed to be, you know, kind of a chance, I guess, to get the peace process going before the penalties get imposed. By Trump's account, the meeting went great. He said they made great progress It's unclear what progress they made, but Trump was really happy with it. And now there's talk, Trump talked about it on Wednesday evening after the Witkoff visit, and the Russian government has confirmed it, that Trump and Putin are now planning to have a summit at some point in the coming days. The details haven't been decided upon, so the actual date, the location, these things are still up in the air, but they are planning to have a summit. Trump claimed that their bilateral summit would then be followed by a trilateral summit involving the two of them and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The Russian government has pushed back against that part of it, saying they are not ready. Putin is not ready to meet with Zelensky, but they are confirming that the meeting with Trump is supposed to go ahead. So that's where things stand. It's still very up in the air, you know, as I say, when or where this is going to happen. But Trump is once again, I guess, on the Putin, Putin is my friend train. And we'll see what he gets out of that.
But there is this tariff threat.
Right. So as far as I know, and the White House said this after Trump's, you know, little gushing thing about what a great meeting Witkoff and Putin had, the tariff threat is unchanged. It's still, this is still going to happen on Friday. You know, Trump could, of course, find a way to wriggle out of this. Now he has an excuse to say, well, look, we've got the summit on the schedule now. And that's, you know, that's the kind of progress I was looking for. So we don't have to go ahead with these penalties. But as far as I know, at this point, as we're recording this, the plan is still to impose what we've been told would be very severe secondary tariffs on Russian oil. So what that means is any country, this includes potentially India, potentially China, you know, any country that buys Russian oil would be hit with a 100% tariff. Basically, they would be it would become extremely cost prohibitive for them to do business in the United States. If that's the structure that he's going for. So, we'll see. But as I say, the plan is still at this point for those penalties to come into, to effect, or at least to be announced on Friday.
So El Salvador, the Congress there has removed presidential term limits. Tell us about it, Derek.
This is good news for one of Trump's best, buddies, I guess, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. The Salvadoran Congress voted on Thursday to approve a constitutional amendment that both lengthens presidential terms from 5 to 6 years and removes term limits altogether. Salvadoran presidents previously were limited to 1 5-year term without the possibility for reelection, although Bukele ran for reelection last year anyway and was allowed to do it because the Salvadoran Supreme Court, which he stacked with judges, said that it would be a violation of his human rights not to allow him to run for president again. And so he ran and won, of course. He's still very popular in El Salvador. But this is a step, I think, toward, you know, making him president for life without having the hassle of, you know, having to have the hassle of going back to the court every time he's up for reelection and have the court make another ruling that says, yes, he's allowed to do this, even though it violates the strict letter of the Constitution. Now it doesn't violate that anymore, and he can just run for president indefinitely or in perpetuity.
Great news. Yeah. Let's turn to the greatest country in the goddamn world, and that is the United States. And let's start with this trafficking agreement that was made with Rwanda.
The administration announced earlier this week, I believe over the weekend, actually, or no, it was Monday or Tuesday, sorry, that it had reached agreement with the Rwandan government under which Rwanda will take in as many as 250 people who are trafficked there by the United States. This is one of these so-called third country agreements whereby the administration takes people who, for some reason, it either cannot or does not want to deport to their countries of origin, and instead will traffic them to a third country, probably to go into, you know, a prison somewhere. This is very similar to what Trump did with Bukele in El Salvador's CICOT counterterrorism prison. Where he sent, you know, dozens of Venezuelan migrants effectively earlier this year. They've since been released in a prisoner exchange between the U.S. and the Venezuelan government. But it's a similar deal. It's also similar to a plan that the U.K. government tried to work out with Rwanda under the previous conservative administration that eventually wound up being scrapped because UK courts kept ruling that it was flagrantly illegal, both under international law and UK law. But the Rwanda government has expressed repeatedly its interest in being paid by Western countries to take in migrants. And so it was a willing participant in this scheme with the Trump administration. It becomes the third country in Africa alongside Eswatini and South Sudan to agree to one of these deals where they take in migrants and are, you know, paid for the service by the Trump administration.
And let's talk about this new program that forces travelers to pay bonds to the American government.
This is a pilot program that the State Department announced on Tuesday. It covers, for the time being, it will most likely be expanded, but for the time being, it covers people attempting to enter the U.S. on business or tourist visas from Malawi and Zambia, which are apparently two countries whose travelers exhibit high rates of overstay. Basically, you know, sticking around beyond the legally allowed time limit under whatever visa they obtain. The idea is that for people from those countries to obtain business or tourist visas or to use those visas to enter the United States, they will be required to put down a $15,000 bond. And if they leave before the expiration of their visa, that bond will be returned to them. If not, then the bond is forfeited to the U.S. government. So it's an attempt to bring these overstay rates down and just make it more inconvenient and painful for people to come to the United States. I mean, the ultimate goal here, I think, is just to shut down business and tourist travel altogether. It seems to be anyway. And I think that's probably at least what the effect will be.
People are not thinking of Las Vegas. But Derek, in good news, NASA has apparently been getting my letters over the years. They never write back, but they aren't ignoring me. So tell me what their new plan is.
It's exciting. They're going to build a nuclear reactor. I think this is one of your letters. They're going to build a nuclear reactor on the moon by 2030.
Thank God.
This is very exciting. I mean, you know, the moon has been crying out for nuclear power. You know, goddamn it.
Ever since man looked at the moon 5,000 years ago,
trying to stick a nuclear reactor.
They longed to put a nuke on it.
this is apparently the plan to build a nuclear reactor on the moon by 2030 that would support a permanent lunar base. The U.S. has to do this soon because if we don't do it, China will do it, I guess. And I don't have to tell you what that would mean. Please don't ask me because I don't know what it would mean, but it would be bad somehow if China did it first. And it's going to go great. I mean, you know, this country is capable of anything it sets its mind to, as anybody can tell. So I think it's going to be a brilliant success.
Maybe we'll blow up the moon. That'll be a big change in human history.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Again, check out Welcome to the Crusades at welcometothecrusades.com. Review us on Apple. It doesn't take very long. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.